Plants. Hello, I'm Kelly D. Welcome to another episode of Watershed Moments, a show that highlights the work of the North Coast Watershed Association, or NCWA, and our partners. And in this episode, yes, plants. I talked with my friend, mentor, and the Resources Stewardship Program Lead at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park, Carla Cole, about native and non-native plants, what that means, why it matters, and how folks living on the north coast of Oregon might ourselves become naturalized members of our ecosystems.
All right, so I'm Carla Cole. I'm the Resources Stewardship Program Lead at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park, and I've been here since about 2008.
Nice. We're hanging out. This is the South Slough Trail, and we're here sort of looking at the wetlands around the mouth of Colwort Creek. Carla started by telling me about how in 2007, restoration projects started happening around Colwort Creek and the adjacent wetlands. To get all those juicy details, listen to our habitat restoration episode. But basically, these restoration actions turned former horse pastures back into wetlands, pulling out tide gates to restore tidal flow and replacing a lot of the non-native forbs like bird's foot trefoil and grasses like reed canary grass with a more diverse native plant community. Some native plants came back on their own, especially lower marsh species like cattails, hard and soft stem bulrush, lingbees sedge, and western liliopsis. And they continue to find new native species that have made their way back on the tides, including in the summer of 2022 during annual wetland monitoring when yours truly was part of a crew who found an unrecognized species that turned out to be Limacella acaulis, or Owyhee mudwort, which was previously undocumented in the park and hadn't been seen in Clatsop County since 1915. So that was pretty exciting stuff for a plant nerd like myself. Other species were intentionally planted, especially in areas of higher elevation where there's more plant competition. These native species included Nootka rose, crabapple, quinberry, thimbleberry, Douglas spiraea, western red cedar, and Sitka spruce. And in areas where upper layers of soil full of reed canary grass were dug down to lower marsh elevations, one very special plant was also seeded. And that plant is wapato. If you're not familiar with wapato, you're in for a treat. William Clark compared it in taste, starch content, and cultural importance to the indigenous peoples of the Lower Columbia as the potato was to the Irish. Its beautiful arrowhead-shaped leaves and small white flowers show up in our wetlands every summer, and varieties of it grow all over the continent in marshy areas. These treatments targeted at recreating a natural wetland, like most all restoration actions, were imperfect, so there's still plenty of reed canary grass around, but there's a lot more biodiversity now.
Yeah, and so the swamp is more populated by native plants now, and therefore more ecologically functional. And so I want to talk a little bit more about why and how native plants like play this role. And why we should care. Let's start with, like, what is a native plant to Carla Cole? Because I know there's a million different ways to look at it. And when I talk about native plants personally, I, like, think about, thousands of years in a place that has co-evolved with other plants and bugs. And, you know,
right.
Like, entomologists have a huge insight here. So, like, what's your take on it? Like,
well, the reason I laugh is because it sounds like such a simple question, right?
Right.
But I think the more you know about it, the more complicated that question becomes, like most things. I think it's that really that co-evolution in that deep time and that interrelationship that the plants and the bugs and the people and the landscape have together. So to me, I mean, that is what makes native communities so important and why it's so damaging when that is broken because of the interrelationships that take so much time to co-evolve. And I think that's some of the things that maybe don't... I think the, you know, the easy definition of what's native and not, like the old-timey way of looking at it for a while was more like, what was on, you know, for our country? Like, what was here before the colonizers came? Like, that wasn't, you know, but yeah. Then we like, well, there's, you know, plants and people have traveled all over the world for a long time. So it really, the other, I think the more you dig into it, the more complex it becomes. And also an answer, there's not one answer. It kind of depends on the place and the time. And
totally. But, and also there's sort of these like kind of clear distinctions of like, oh, like we want our native cattails and we want our Sagittaria and we want these plants here, and they depend on this floodplain existing, and this floodplain is like allowing the river to not overtop banks further down the line, and it's creating habitat for bugs and birds that are in turn like creating food sources for other species, salmon in particular.
Fish and people,
yeah, and it's a web of things that native plants are sort of central to in terms of their use in restoration. So, yeah. Okay, cool. So
should we walk into the sun a little bit?
Let's go get some sun. There's a holly.
Kidding. Now, why do hollies matter? Why do we kill the hollies?
These are my questions for you. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it goes back to, you know, that it all depends, and it's species by species and place by place. And so holly, for example, here in the Fort Clatsop unit, there's a couple reasons that we have prioritized treating it, getting rid of it, because we're a historical park. So part of our mandate here is to try to create and restore and maintain the general look of the kind of landscape that the core discovery would have encountered. Here, the historical scene is also the natural and cultural scene. So for that reason alone, that's, you know, it's like, well, holly wasn't here then, we should take it out. That's one reason. That's the kind of aesthetic park visitor experience. But for me, that's not as important as the ecological reason with, you know, we're in the Sitka spruce zone. It's a very rare habitat type on the planet. It's the coastal temperate rainforest. And if we did nothing about the hollies, they are slow growing, but they are persistent. And you know, you can, I mean, your imagination, fast forward a couple hundred years from now, we'd have a lot of holly all over this acreage, instead of what we would like to see is that diverse native resilient plant community that includes Sitka spruce and hemlock and pockets of cedar and salal openings and meadows for elk. And so it gets back to that general, like, why, you know, there's tons of plant species around that aren't from here, that are not native, that are not invasive, that aren't aggressive, that aren't a problem, that we don't do anything, you know, everything we have in our gardens, and a lot of ornamentals are fine too. But it's these ones that it's, you know, it's plants that have these traits where they are, you know, very able to colonize the landscape, they persist on the landscape, and then they radically change the native plant community and do that in a way that greatly reduces the diversity, which doesn't only affect the plant community itself, but like we've been talking about, you know, all of the web of life from the microscopic biome down in the soils, which we know so little about still,
yeah,
to the birds and the bees and the mammals and everything else that's intertwined with them.
Yeah. And I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second, because you mentioned birds eating holly, right? And so it's like, oh, well, the birds like it. That's helpful and integrates it into this web in some
right.
way. So why is that not enough to merit its place here?
So those little birds don't know any better. It looks like berries they evolved to eat. Some of the birds are actually, maybe starlings did co-evolve with holly.
Yeah, no kidding. English starlings.
Yeah, I mean, so if you love your birds and want them to have food on the landscape, I mean, there's so many wonderful native shrubs and trees that provide a variety of fruits year-round, crab apples, Nootka rose, cascara, and those, I would argue, have both the nice berries for the birds, but also the key features of having different blooming times spread throughout the season. So they're also providing pollinators with food. They're just doing so much more and playing such a more critical role as everything is getting so out of whack. Mm-hmm. So when you start thinking of the big picture of what we can do, what matters, if you believe biodiversity matters, then really one of the best ways you can support that is by helping to maintain this diversity of native plants on the landscape. Whereas, like, sure, hollies will give birds and berries for a limited time, but yeah, they're not providing all the services that all the native plants would.
Providing ecological services. That's the bottom line when distinguishing native plants from invasive plants. And while the beauty of a foxglove or the utility of an English laurel hedge certainly provide services to humans, we're just one part of the ecosystem. And sure, what you do on your property might not seem significant, but if these plants spread outside of your control and displace other, more service-oriented plants like goldenrod, vine maple, and salal, then they can become a problem. And it's not always obvious which new plants are going to become problematic until it's too late, because ecosystems are so complex.
There's a classic invasion curve that you'll see on different EDRR, early detection, rapid response weed booklets and stuff, where often with these things like Darwin's bearberry and other ornamental plants, they'll scoot, like, years will go by and they'll be, you know, in people's yards and gardens, and then kind of something happens and it just kicks in, and then the growth on the landscape becomes exponential. You know, like a certain amount of time and plants will kind of lay low for a while, and then they'll just take off. So yeah, I feel like that's one of them that has been kind of lurking quietly in the background, but I'm seeing that one and Cotoneaster, both of those show up in more and more natural areas.
Yeah, that was another interesting. So they're like Cotoneaster. Cotoneaster is a genus of plants. So there's several species that I've seen around, and I think several of them are like escaping cultivation and starting to like cause issue, particularly a smaller leafed variety. I know I've seen on the park, and like
I think we might have walked by one earlier.
I think we did. but you know, it's a species that we, when I worked at a garden center locally, we sold, and yeah, they still sell these things. And so it's really interesting that like this, like, especially because of this sort of timescape that invasive plants work on, where they're lying low for a while and people maybe don't realize they're escaping, and then suddenly it's very clear and it's a little bit out of control at that point, and right, like dialing back becomes difficult, to say the least.
Yeah, it's just yet another reason to that, you know, if you have choices in gardening and landscaping, there's just so many reasons to go native, right? I mean, besides, because even if you think you're doing something benign, it may not turn out to be so in the future.
Yeah.
And then just maintenance, you know, native plants are low maintenance, they're adapted to here, and
totally. Yeah. I really love to harp on, I'm looking at a sword fern right now. It's a little crunchy, but they can survive in like such varied sun exposure areas. Yeah. And they are our godsends when we're scrambling up super steep hills, and they're not going to block your view. Definitely like get a big like shout out to sword ferns as erosion control hill stabilizers in our local area.
Totally. And that's a beautiful, I mean, that's how, what, you know, in natural forest succession here after fire or wind or any natural disturbance, they're, you know, sword ferns and alders will come into those slide zones and play that crucial role of catching dirt, catching dust, holding soil, building it with their dying fronds, and then the alders, nitrogen fixing. And so I think, yeah, it's like, it's all here. Let's make use of it more in our urban landscapes. And
yeah,
sword ferns transplant really easily also.
Yeah. Big fan of the sword fern. And you mentioned nitrogen fixing, which in my initial beginnings of horticulture and gardening and learning about landscapes, I assumed that nitrogen fixation was good across the board. Mm-hmm. Plants need nitrogen. Mm-hmm. But we both know that's not true. Do you want to talk a little bit about the other side of nitrogen and another famous invasive plant in our area?
Sure. Let me see. What could that be?
Yeah, it's very, very ambiguous.
You're really setting me up there. So this goes back to the whole it depends thing, right?
Right.
So because, yeah, agriculturally, if you're growing crops, nitrogen is good. But there's many places on the planet with plant communities that have evolved over time to adapt to and thrive in very low nitrogen soils. And so places like that can be rocky balds, shallow soils, or coastal dunes and prairies. So that is here on the Clatsop Plains. That's how it was for a long time. Beautiful native coastal prairie community evolving and unstabilized dunes, very low nitrogen. And then the plant that you are thinking of right now, our beautiful Scotch broom, was brought in, even before 1900, I believe they started. Oh. Well, maybe not the Scotch. That's when the dune stabilization efforts started on the Clatsop Plains. The history of the Clatsop Plains itself is very interesting, with early settlers bringing their cows out to what they thought was just lovely cow pasture. And then the cow hooves started breaking through the very shallow soils. And then that led to destabilization of the sand, and then people had their houses there, and then they didn't want the sand to blow in it. And so, yeah, I think that was even very early on, there were sand stabilization efforts, but they really took off full force during the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps era. And that's when the broom was planted, and broom did its job. It did a great job of stabilizing the soils, and the Soil Conservation Service at the time also knew that it, being in the pea family, has the ability to fix nitrogen due to a symbiotic relationship with nitrogen fixing bacteria in its roots. And so that was to them at the time, that was another bonus benefit of the Scotch broom. They're like, great, it'll stabilize soils, it'll give nitrogen, good. But then, unfortunately, what happened there, the kind of side effect of that also was, then once the Scotch broom started creating these more fertile soils, then non-native plants like hairy cat's ear and Rumex acetosella, get the common name for that one, and a bunch of grasses, they were like, great. It made it those soils more conducive to the growth and expansion of all these other non-native plants, which then end up out-competing the native plant community that had been adapted to the low nitrogen soils. So that was, besides just crowding out, like just physically in space, you know, the broom overtaking the prairie community, also the soil changes negatively affected it.
Yeah, we're still learning about how these plants are changing our ecosystems.
And again, you know, the whole soil biome is so understudied. I mean, it's being more and more studied now, but, you know, that's a whole other realm of, we're just talking about the macro plants that we can see and animals, but there's so much, you know, who knows how much diversity has already been lost underground. I just think about what you were just saying with the Scotch broom and it really changing things. That's another, I'm trying to remember the term, but kind of in the matrix that we think about when we prioritize what non-native plant species are really problematic, what ones we can live with, what ones we're going to accept. One of the big factors we consider is, I can't remember the right phrase for this, but, you know, I'm just going to say, like, the game changers, the ones that truly, like, totally alter the physical environment in such a way that the native plant community can't be there anymore. And another one that does that besides Scotch broom is reed canary grass. And I think that that's another, you know, it's not just that reed canary grass is physically occupying space and replacing diverse native marsh communities with a monoculture, but it's also because of its rhizomatous mat collecting and trapping sediment and actually raising the elevation. And like I said earlier, in the estuary, elevation's destiny, so you lose this whole, the lower marsh community. Is simply physically impossible for it to be there anymore.
It's hard to quantify exactly how much humans have changed our landscapes. Sometimes you have to know a lot of history to realize that what looks like a nice walkable forest is actually missing its understory, or that these grass-covered sand dunes were once shifting sands amongst more diverse coastal prairie plants. Coastal prairies, by their definition, are dynamic, fire-mediated, low-nitrogen areas that don't bode well with human development, which depends on stability. So we've lost 99% of them. We only have 1% of our historic coastal prairies left in Oregon. There are efforts to bring them back, spearheaded by the Institute of Applied Ecology, the North Coast Land Conservancy, and the National Park Service. And something that the NCWA is doing to help these efforts is working with local farmers to grow Viola adunca, or early blue violets, and collect the seeds. These unassuming little flowers are the exclusive host plant for the Oregon silver spot butterfly's larva. Those picky little buggers won't eat anything else. This butterfly was listed as threatened in 1980 and serves as a signal species for the well-being of our coastal prairie habitats, where early blue violets evolved. One of the NCWA's growers for this project is Ryan Kennedy, purveyor of the up-and-coming Rewild Native Plant Nursery, who is working hard to generate these seeds that will not only benefit future restoration projects, but also add a desirable and rare plant to his nursery's repertoire.
Start with thank you for growing violas for the NCWA. That was it's a very generous thing for you to do, and it's a pretty big plot that you have.
Yeah.
How big is it?
We got 550 plants in there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We out there within the enclosure planted them just directly into the grounds through holes in the geotextile that yours truly got to burn in there. But yeah, like not a lot of prep, and they still are doing really well.
Did really well.
Because they're native.
I found them to be incredibly resilient, especially knowing that in a lot of their historic habitat, they've just grown straight into sand dunes, which you know, it's a very opposite paradigm to how we think about plants. You know, a lot of us grew up connecting with plants through like the vegetable garden, and you have to like nourish and get all these supplements to the soil, where meadow plants, you know, they can operate on nothing, which is really cool.
I love that so much. So meadows, prairies, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about coastal prairies, one of your personal passions, and a very fitting passion for a grower of Viola adunca. So tell me a little bit about the carbon sequestration angle of coastal prairies. Not only are they super easy to care for with their native plants around here and things like that, but they also have this additional benefit of carbon sequestration.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a really kind of fascinating component of what those things can do for the ecosystem, because it gives a lot of folks that with smaller pieces of land an opportunity to kind of tie into this like larger, you know, growing global interest in carbon drawdown and carbon sequestration. And, you know, studies have been done on meadows, which is really just, it's a broad term for grasslands, grass-dominated ecosystems. And, you know, we forget that a lot of those native grasses and native forbs have roots that go down 10, 15 feet. And these meadows, as they reach year two and three, they're pulling all that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and mm-hmm. they're sequestering that into carbon. But because they're not a woody plant like a tree, they're not putting any of it in their trunk, so to say. It's going into the soil. And so they're actually sequestering a lot of the carbon that they draw down into the soil. It feeds the microbes. It does a whole lot of benefits.
Wow.
And, you know, not a whole lot of studies have been done on it to this point, but the ones that have been done have demonstrated that, you know, it is absolutely having a significant impact on carbon drawdown, and it's, you know, it's something that a lot of us can do.
Big thank you to Ryan and to all of our Viola growers for helping us take the leftover plants from a past project and turn them into a community-driven native plant initiative. We couldn't do it without y'all. Let's start making coastal prairie corridors in the corners of public lands and people's backyards. You can learn more about his nursery on Instagram at rewildlandscape, and you can email me at ncwaprograms@gmail.com to learn more about our Viola project. Back to colewort, Carla and I turned our attention to naturalized plants, those non-natives that escape cultivation but that don't seem to disrupt existing functional ecosystems, and how maybe we can learn a thing or two from them.
But back on the naturalized business, I think about, I love what Robin Wall Kimmerer said about it in Braiding Sweetgrass with, and it's not just about plant communities, but kind of people too, and everything being interconnected, and how... you know, living like here, us in North America, what we can learn looking at plants and plant communities and how we think about them and what's native and what's not, and how, you know, as the offspring of colonizers, you and I can never hope to be indigenous here.
Indeed.
But we can become naturalized, and that's what I like that way of thinking. And so botanically or ecologically, when you talk of a species being naturalized, it's something that's not from the place, that hasn't had that coevolution in relationship over deep time, and yet it's not causing harm.
Yeah.
It plays nicely with others is a way it's commonly told. And those are things like you know, the occasional apple or cherry tree you might see driving down the road that is from a seed somewhere. It's not from here, but it's not really causing too much harm. And there's a you know, a whole group of ornamentals that kind of escape here and there or persist here and there that kind of fit that definition.
Let's all naturalize. Well, folks, there you have it, an introduction to native and non-native plants on the North Oregon coast. To learn more about all kinds of plants in Oregon, you can visit theamazingoregonflora.org to see great detailed plant photos and get great information about so many plants you might encounter in the state. And if you want help identifying those plants, you can download an app called Seek or its sister iNaturalist, which can take a photo and give you an idea of what you're looking at. And if you would like to share plant information directly with the NCWA, you can download the plant form of our web map application at our website, clatsopwatersheds.org. You can learn more about the plants of Lewis and Clark National Historical Park at nps.gov/lewi. Thank you to Nick Jaina for the music and to Dr. Jacob Job of the Sound and Light Ecology Team at Colorado State University and the Natural Sounds and Night Skies Division of the National Park Service for the bird songs in this episode. Thank you so much to Carla Cole and Ryan Kennedy for talking with me. I'm your host, Kelly D. Take care and remember, water is life. Agua es vida.